Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
And now, heated debate on the Senate floor today as Democrats voice outrage over a report that President Bush gave the National Security Agency possibly unconstitutional permission to spy on Americans. Today's New York Times reports that following the 9/11 terrorist attacks, President Bush authorized the NSA to conduct wiretaps on Americans without the court-approved warrants that are ordinarily required for domestic spying. And that story now threatens to waylay today's Senate vote on the USA Patriot Act, which is set to expire at the end of the year. This morning, Democratic Senator Edward Kennedy seized on the New York Times report and lashed out at the president during floor debate on the Patriot Act.
This administration feels it's above the law, and the American people and our Constitution pay the price.
But earlier on the Today Show, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, defended the president.
The President of the United States acted lawfully in every step that he has taken to defend the American people and to defend them within his constitutional responsibility.
Well, the news comes as the Pentagon was forced to acknowledge earlier this week that it is reviewing possible misuse of a classified database that tracked activities of anti-war protesters who were found to not be security threats. Joining us on the line is Kate Martin, Executive Director of the Center for National Security Studies in Washington, D.C. And Kate, first of all, what is your reaction to the story of this authorization of domestic wiretaps without warrants?
It's astounding to me and horrifying. It's the imperial presidency run amok. The notion that the president can authorize the NSA to violate the law and wiretap on Americans is truly frightening.
But and now let's just be clear: is there legal wiretapping of Americans, and how is that done?
Yes, and in fact, there are two different laws that provide for ways for the government to wiretap Americans and get warrants. One is a criminal law, and then there's a national security warrant procedure called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And it allows the NSA or the FBI to wiretap Americans in national security cases after they get approval and warrants from the special court.
Well, now, the report goes on to say that congressional leaders were told about the surveillance by the National Security Agency without warrants. And the report also says the president had legal opinions to back up his decision.
Well, what's truly remarkable here and most important is that the law makes it a crime for any government agency to wiretap without getting a warrant. And if the New York Times is correct, what must have happened is that the president asked for and got a legal opinion that he had the power to ignore the criminal law passed by the Congress.
Well, in fact, the government's Justice Department lawyer wrote in an internal memo that while these actions of having NSA operatives spying on Americans without warrants could raise constitutional issues, in the face of devastating terrorist attacks, the government may be justified in taking measures which, in less troubled conditions, could be seen as infringements of individual liberties. So the government is saying that the post-11 climate warranted this.
Well, it is truly remarkable that they would make that claim. They could have gotten a warrant for this kind of wiretapping in no time, and it takes no time, and the warrants and the wiretaps are secret. And so they didn't even have a practical justification for breaking the law, if that's what in fact happened.
Well, and the Times report says that the National Security Agency wanted to monitor bigger batches of phone calls more quickly, and that is the reason they gave for this move. We should note that the New York Times is not doing interviews on this story today, and the reporters noted in their story that the newspaper held this information for a year at the request of the White House, which cited security reasons. So there are going to be questions raised, Kate Martin, in journalistic circles, I'm sure, as well about this report. Kate Martin, Executive Director of the Center for National Security Studies, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, the fallout from the story of wiretapping Americans without court approval is also being felt in Congress as the Senate debates whether to extend the USA Patriot Act, the law which allows for increased surveillance of terror suspects and expires on December 31st. Today, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist called on senators to renew the law.
A vote against the Patriot Act amounts to retreat in defeat here at home against terrorism. To those who still harbor concerns with this bill, I have a simple reply. We have more to fear from terrorists than this Patriot Act compromise.
But, of course, there were other opinions as well. Joining us on the line from Capitol Hill is Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And, Gail, tell us, how is the New York Times story we just spoke of, the president reportedly authorizing the National Security Agency to spy on Americans without warrants, how is that playing out in the discussion on the Patriot Act on Capitol Hill?
Well, we will know in just a couple of minutes. They're voting as we speak, but the just hearing senators talk about it this morning, it was a bombshell, and the timing could not have been more appropriate for this bill. Senator Specter said that this was inexcusable, clearly and categorically wrong, and it will be a matter for oversight in the new year. But he also said that it was disconcerting to see these headlines this morning, and he suggested that the story had been held back for more than a year, and that he certainly wouldn't want to suggest that it was timed for this vote. But, of course, that's exactly what he did.
We think we also heard Senator Schumer say on C-SPAN that today's report is affecting his vote on the Patriot Act.
Yes, he did. Yeah. And I think that's especially among moderate senators. I mean, this was very serious. When you just played for listeners, Senator Frist's comment this morning about this being a choice between much like the decision in Iraq between a retreat and defeat at home, that speech I think might have been written before the New York Times speech, because mm-hmm. what's very much on people's mind this morning is the threat at home, especially the threat from big government.
Well, Gail, can you just help clarify, because there's so much information here at once from different sources. The New York Times report about the president authorizing a government agency to spy on Americans without warrants, is that part of the Patriot Act?
No. No, that's a separate element. In fact, it might be possible for someone to argue that some of the new protections against government overreach in the Patriot Act are better than what we're currently living with. But it does speak to the question of, can you trust government, which is a big subliminal aspect through all of this discussion. Can you give government broader powers, assured that they will abide by them? This comes out especially on issues like Section 215 that deals with business records, library records, and so-called, national security letters. Can you trust the judicial review and the government to act in a way that's responsible?
Well, I want to ask you
why this is such an important report this morning.
Right, and I want to ask you one more question about the report before we focus on the Patriot Act, because the New York Times is also reporting that congressional leaders of both parties knew about this surveillance authorized by the president. So have any members on the floor addressed that?
Well, Senator Specter did. If anyone would know, he would, and he said it's clearly and categorically wrong. So this is something I need to get into immediately. The other thing that does come out in the New York Times reporting as well, however, is various points at which government officials rolled back what they were doing and questioned it. So I think that's the other aspect the senator is going to be looking into. To what extent did the government itself self-correct? And is that kind of redeeming aspect of this story?
Yeah, because
right now it's all too fresh.
And we should say that this practice, again, of authorizing the NSA to spy on Americans without a warrant was temporarily canceled, but then started up again.
That's right.
Well, let's turn to the Patriot Act. Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont said that the Democrats don't want the bill to expire. Let's listen to him first.
Our goal is to mend the Patriot Act, not to end it. None of us want it to expire. And those who threaten to let it expire rather than fix it are playing a dangerous game.
Who does want it to expire? Gail?
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
They were just announcing the vote.
Well, be sure and let us know what you're hearing.
Right. I'm sorry. You were just playing what?
We were just playing Senator Leahy saying that he worked very hard to form the Patriot Act, doesn't want it to expire, wants it to be mended. As you said, they're voting on right now whether or not to continue this debate over it or to start a vote. Who does want the Patriot Act to expire?
This is brinksmanship. Both the White House and Senator Frist said this morning that if cloture is blocked on this vote, that is, if opponents of the Patriot Act succeed in allowing it to come to a vote, then the Patriot Act, these extensions, simply die at that point. The Act is not reauthorized. Now, that's a kind of tough stance. They didn't have to say that. They could say the president could push for another 3 months. But the fact that he, and especially Senator Frist, are not doing that is classic brinksmanship. But I think he's going to have trouble with it.
And this is Gail Chadha, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, listening to a vote in Congress as she speaks to us, which we so appreciate. Gail, could you just explain this procedure a little bit? What are they voting on right now?
They're voting on a cloture motion. That means a decision to end the debate on the Patriot Act and go to a vote. What the Republican leadership and the White House wants is for debate to end, go to a vote. A vote on the Patriot Act will extend 14 of the 16 sections that are set to expire by the 31st of December. If this vote fails, that is, if the supporters of the bill are not able to get 60 votes to break the debate, then the White House and Senator Frist say that nothing else will happen. The debate will go on, the bill won't get reauthorized, and on the 1st of January, 12 midnight, the wall separating intelligence and law enforcement will go back up and we'll all be less safe. If you listen to the terms of this debate, there's a lot of talk from the Republican leadership on things like, if there is another terrorist attack, Congress will be responsible because they were the ones who let this tool expire. Brinksmanship.
We should say that, and I think you have noted, but make it clear that Senate Republicans are on record as opposing parts of the Patriot Act this time around. That's different from 4 years ago when only one voted against it.
That's right.
And what does that say to you?
One of the reasons that they voted against it was because one of the reasons it had so much support was precisely that features of it were going to be sunsetted and that there would be a serious debate in 4 years. Well, here we are. Those features are sunsetting. And there is a serious debate. And the element that nobody expected last night was that we'd also be looking at government overreach in this other area that we've been discussing.
Do you think, Gail Chadha, that there's been a shift in the floor that you can feel and that it might change the vote because of the New York Times report this morning about a separate issue of the president authorizing spying on Americans?
I think it will.
Yeah.
That's why I'm sitting here in a distracted way trying to see what's happening on the floor. The discussions I had with senators this morning, there was real shock about this. I mean, senators, they don't shock easily, but the timing of this couldn't have been worse for this bill.
Well, Gail Chadha, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Tell you what, we're going to give Gail a few seconds break to listen in on Congress, and then she's going to come back after a minute to tell us more about what she's hearing on the floor there. Very exciting moment as lawmakers debate the Patriot Act and debate even voting on the Patriot Act. They have other things on their desks today, and we'll try to learn more about that when we come back. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Now, we're continuing our conversation with Gail Chadha of the Christian Science Monitor. She's back on the line from Capitol Hill. Gail, first of all, anything happen in the minute where we were gone?
Well, they're close to 40 votes, but not there yet. And what's tricky about it is that the 40 votes would be the critical number for reaching cloture. You also don't know if a vote's going to change at the last minute. So we're still waiting.
And this could go on for some time. Again, we're talking about, well, explain for us again, in your words, this vote that we're listening to.
The cloture vote determines whether or not you end debate on the Patriot Act. And if it fails, then it means that
the Patriot Act will not be renewed.
Well, Gail, let's tick through some of the other issues Congress is supposed to be grappling with as it heads into the holiday, and it seems as if with this Patriot Act debate.
Sorry, I just said that exactly wrong.
Oh.
If the cloture vote succeeds, then that ends the debate, and we will go to a vote. If the cloture vote fails, that means debate goes on.
Sorry. Okay. Okay. No, well, look, went right by me. So let's tick through some of the other issues that Congress was expected to be grappling with today as they look forward to going home for the holidays. And it sounds as if the Patriot Act is taking up more time than originally thought. There's immigration, drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, deficit reduction. Why so much so last minute?
That's always the way. At the end of the session, it is the force of deadlines always pulls together compromises. But this year is very unusual because a Republican Congress that has been pretty much walking in lockstep with the president has broken away on a number of very key issues, from the torture amendment, which is has held up both the defense authorization and the defense appropriation bill. This was Senator John McCain making a point months ago that torture is unacceptable and that regardless of what the White House says its needs are, it's not how this country, it doesn't represent what the country is. That amendment has been very controversial, but has picked up so much support in both the House and the Senate that the White House backed down on it yesterday. So that was one very big item. The others are ANWR. ANWR is drilling in the Arctic Regional Refuge, has been one of these issues that is deeply controversial, cutting into both parties, and right now it's bouncing between, will it be part of the reconciliation package? Currently, no. Will it therefore go to the defense spending package and hold that up as well? So there are critical things that have to pass. The most important are the labor, health and human services spending bill, $602 billion. They should have voted on that today. But no Democrat will support it, and there aren't enough Republicans currently in town to pass it.
Gail Chad, a congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, we hear all sorts of bells and whistles going off behind you. We know you want to pay attention to what's going on in Congress. We're going to let you go to do that and talk to you about it in the future. Gail, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, it's time now to open up the Here and Now mailbag, and there are a few of your thoughts. And first, we misspoke. In our report on President Bush's most recent speech on Iraq, we said he accepted responsibility for faulty intelligence leading up to the war. But as David Wright of Wellesley, Massachusetts points out, President Bush did not take responsibility for the bad intelligence that supported his war. He said there was wrong information. Then he said he took responsibility for sending the troops in based on that wrong information. Right you are, Mr. Wright. We also recently explored the movement to send three-year-olds to public schools, which backers say will close the achievement gap suffered largely by low-income kids. Well, Hilton Evans of Randolph, Massachusetts, isn't buying it. He writes, "Let's say what this movement is really about. Several hundred bucks per week for daycare can cut into a soccer mom's budget. What easier way is there to get this cost off a working mom or dad's back than to dump it on the backs of us taxpayers and get buy-in by pretending it has to do with strengthening education?" We also heard from Mary Scriver of Valier, Montana, after our story on the kerfuffle over what to call the tree that launches the holiday season. The Reverend Jerry Falwell and others want it called a Christmas tree. Mary, a former Unitarian Universalist minister, says, "The argument over who owns the decorated evergreen has me rolling on the floor. Originally, it was from the Druid pagan religion in Northern Europe. Then it was co-opted by Victorian Christians who never passed up an opportunity to sell, decorate, and possess." Falwell should know that there is a tree in the Holy Land that symbolizes birth. It is the palm tree. And Doug Kincaid of Wachuca City, Arizona, wrote after our report on the Reach the Beach relay race in New Hampshire. In the story, several runners, women and men, were spotted wearing red dresses. Doug writes, "That pack of runners in red dresses must have been a group of hashers, Hash House Harriers. The tradition dates back to 1988 when a woman showed up at a race in a red dress. I started hashing when stationed in Korea back in 1990 and will continue until I cannot negotiate the trail with my walker." And finally, we reported on the mysterious theft of hundreds of street lamps in Baltimore, just as that city tries to brand itself with a new motto. A local columnist half-jokingly said that new motto should be about the theft of the streetlights, but some citizens want to tie the new slogan to the fact that Francis Scott Key wrote the Star-Spangled Banner in Baltimore. Well, Joey Horsley of Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts writes, the obvious solution to Baltimore's branding quest, combining national anthem and streetlight theft themes, is Baltimore, oh say can you see? Well, as always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now. Now, ballots from Iraq's first free parliamentary elections are being collected and counted today. More than 11 million Iraqis cast their ballots on a day that saw little of the violence that had plagued the country since the invasion. The pictures of Iraqis with ink-stained fingers are a welcome change from those of civilians killed by car bombs and suicide attacks that appear in newspapers and on TV with numbing regularity. Iraqis have paid a steep price in civilian lives since the invasion. Earlier this week, President Bush, after a speech in Philadelphia, was asked how many Iraqis, military or civilian, had died in the war. Here's what he said.
I would say 30,000, more or less, have died as a result of the initial incursion and the ongoing violence against Iraqis.
Here to talk about the significance of that statement and about the number of Iraqis killed in the war is Sarah Sewell of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard University. Sarah, thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
And first, let's start with the president's number. Do you think 30,000 is accurate?
We have no way of knowing what an accurate number is. And I think what the initial question is, how does the president have any understanding of the number? And he so assiduously refused to engage in any discussion about the number. I think the fact that he's used this figure really breaks open a wider discussion that we have been long delayed in having.
Well, isn't it rare for a president to speak directly about civilian casualties?
I mean, it's certainly rare for this administration. I said at the very beginning of this war, I thought given the stress that they had made on their intention to avoid harming civilians in Iraq, that they would be forced to reckon with the actual results of their actions. And yet they've continually said they don't keep numbers, they're not concerned with numbers, it's not their business to deal with numbers. And so I do think that there is real meaning in the president's actually putting that on the table as something worth discussing.
What do you think that meaning is?
I think it points to the fact that someone in the White House, and now we know the president, actually does pay attention to this question of the number. The number has limited utility, but it certainly bears on our understanding of the validity of the war and our way of assessing the war. And it certainly also tells us something very important about the lack of knowledge that we have about the specifics of that number.
In other words, I think I'm hearing you say the worth of the war, I mean, in lives lost.
The traditional way that the West has reckoned with war is to apply what we call the just war ethic, which includes some understanding of the civilian costs. And if we don't have any way of quantifying it, we have no way of understanding it. And so it's very important that we not lose that understanding.
Well, now, you worked for the Department of Defense during the Clinton administration. What is the military policy on civilian casualties? How do they keep track?
That it's not their responsibility to count. And while they will, in certain incidents, keep some log of what transpired and what they understood the results to be, it's not systematic, it's not comprehensive, and most importantly, it's not analyzed for lessons.
So is there anyone whose job it is in the administration waging war to keep track of the casualties of the civilians?
Unfortunately, in this era, that responsibility has been, in effect, delegated by default to the press and to non-governmental agencies and human rights organizations. And they've played a critical role, I think, in doggedly insisting that it's worth tracking this number. And the president's acknowledgement that the number has some bearing on our understanding and assessment of the war is significant. And now the real task for this administration is to help us understand as Americans or as a global community, what does that number mean? What can it tell us? What does it not tell us? And what do we need to be learning from it?
Hmm. And by the way, he said this number in response to a question. And that also was unusual, that someone was actually able to ask him at the Council of Foreign Affairs. But he could have been more elusive.
As administration officials have been consistently, right. And he didn't. He took it head on.
Do you think one of the reasons that the administration is talking about civilian deaths may be that a number of deaths are now being caused by insurgents' attacks, so it's easier to talk about deaths when it's not just at the hands of coalition soldiers?
If you look at the life cycle of the administration's attitude toward civilian casualties, they started off prior to the war talking about how they would make every effort to avoid them, and then they were completely silent on the question of numbers. And when the Iraqi ministry in its nascent form began releasing figures about Iraqi civilians who had been killed, it would appear that they were asked to stop reporting those numbers. It was really only when the public focus turned to the insurgency and the improvised explosive devices and the purposeful targeting of civilians that the Iraqi ministry and then the Pentagon itself began to release figures about civilian deaths solely in the context of insurgent-caused civilian deaths. So there's no question that our willingness to count, our willingness to speak publicly about numbers is in no small part shaped by our understanding of who bears responsibility for those deaths.
Even though the number is not small, not insignificant, but some would say relative to other conflicts, it is.
I think that's exactly right, Robin. It's very important for Americans to both to contextualize the number by understanding how it would feel if it were a number about their own country and their own experience, but also to understand that in historical terms, this number is minuscule. It is nothing compared to the degree of civilian harm that occurred in the world wars, compared to Korea, compared to Vietnam, compared to many of the civil wars raging around the globe today. Even if you look at the Iraq body counts breakdown of how they surmise the deaths to have occurred, somewhere in the range of 3,000 to 4,000 would have occurred in the context of the major combat operations phase to topple a dictator and liberate an entire country. That's an astonishingly small number.
Yeah, but still of concern to you.
Absolutely. Every civilian death is a concern. Nobody intends for civilian deaths to occur in war. And the United States makes an enormous effort to minimize civilian harm in the way it applies force, but it doesn't study the effects of its actions. And absent studying how well it does, you really are left with the question of whether or not we could be doing an even better job.
Sarah Sewell, there are a lot of Americans for whom every death is very painful. But, you know, I'm thinking that there are a lot of Americans who don't know Iraqis, and this is a number. Do you think Americans, by and large, care that many Iraqis were killed?
I think it's important for Americans to try to put themselves in an Iraqi context and imagine what would happen if the shoe were on the other foot. I mean, these numbers, if they're accurate, imply somewhere in the order of over 100,000 American civilians being killed in the context of a war to liberate their country. And the jury's still out on whether the results of that war are going to result in a better future for the citizens of the country at issue, in this case, Iraq. So it's, I think, only by beginning to understand the enormity of that number in a comparative context that Americans can sort of get the idea that Iraqis have, particularly since the war was so localized in its effects, been really traumatized by the violence that's accompanied this war of liberation.
So do you think Americans are becoming less tolerant of civilian casualties overall?
There's an increased sensitivity to the human costs of war, regardless of who's paying that price. I do think there's obviously a much greater sensitivity toward the American loss of life than there is Iraqis. And when we can get to the day that every life counts as much as our next-door neighbors would, we will have a very different world.
Sarah Sewell, a lecturer at the Carr Center on Human Rights at Harvard University. Sarah, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And you're listening to Here and Now. From Mamma Mia to Movin' Out, there have been a raft of musicals on Broadway that feature the work of pop stars. Well, now there's a new guy in town, several of them, in fact, in one show. Jersey Boys features the music of New Jersey's own Four Seasons during the 1960s. Led by the unmistakable voice of Frankie Valli, the Four Seasons had over 20 top 40 hits. Here's a sample. Just a taste of the music of the Four Seasons. Now imagine trying to recreate the sound of Frankie Valli while you're making your Broadway debut. That was the challenge faced by actor John Lloyd Young, who plays Valli in the new production, and judging by the reviews, has had spectacular success. He joins us now from the Carnegie Hall Studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
When did you first hear Frankie Valli?
I was 7 years old. I was watching TV. I was watching a commercial break and a compilation, probably on cassettes at that point, of oldies came on, and they had old black and white footage of the groups singing, and on came the Four Seasons and this little Italian guy singing like a girl. 20 years later, I'm singing like a girl every night on Broadway.
And not only that, I mean, you know, just the fact that you heard this on this sort of infomercial, that's sort of the graveyard, you know, of rock acts. And here, you know, this whole rebirth is happening now. But I'm wondering, then you go to, you know, cast for the part. You're an actor. Did you think of yourself as a singer?
Well, I had always sung. And, you know, I grew up, I had a sort of special situation in childhood. My natural mother passed away when I was very little. Mm-hmm. And my father remarried soon thereafter. I grew up with a stepmother who was the only mother I remember. Mm-hmm. As a result of that, I grew up with three sets of grandparents. And their music was a big influence. So there was a lot of Sinatra playing in my childhood. I was a singer, but I didn't have any use for it in the theater. I always sang, and I started singing from when I was a little kid, but it was this Sinatra sort of standard stuff, jazz stuff, not really appropriate for any musical theater sort of a piece. Out of the blue, this show comes that is about a singer who was also influenced by Frank Sinatra and those people, but who ended up inventing his own sound. So it ultimately was a very good fit for someone like me with my musical background and tastes.
Had you done that kind of falsetto singing? Had you tried to go up in that way?
I had done that, but only to sort of joke around. And I think you couldn't do this role or you couldn't be Frankie Valli himself unless you had a natural falsetto. And I had sort of discovered it by accident as a child or a young adult when you realize you have a special skill that you don't really have any use for, and you just take it out at parties or to amuse your friends or to annoy your girlfriends. And I had certainly had no use for it in plays. There's no singing at all.
Right.
So it was a surprise to me and a happy accident that it was such a skill, a latent skill, and that there was a way to exploit it. And it was a key to playing this great role in such a huge show.
Well, in fact, let's hear a little Frankie Valli first, and then a little John Lloyd Young.
Me down the
Walk Like a Man, as sung by both Frankie Valli and John Lloyd Young, who's starring as Valli in Jersey Boys, the new Broadway production about the Four Seasons. We'll have more about the musical coming up. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. And now.
My eyes adored you. Though I never laid a hand on you, my eyes adored you.
That's John Lloyd Young performing My Eyes Adored You from the new Broadway musical Jersey Boys, the story of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. It's written by Marshall Brickman and Rick Elise, with music by the Seasons' Bob Gaudio and lyrics by Bob Crew. And it's been getting rave reviews on Broadway for its tale of up-from-nothing success and ultimate painful partings. Many reviewers have said this musical, unlike many of the jukebox shows now on Broadway, actually has a dramatic storyline. Actor John Lloyd Young has much off-Broadway stage experience prior to Jersey Boys. He was named one of 2004's best featured actors in a play by the New Jersey Star-Ledger. But he practically channels Frankie Valli in this, his Broadway debut, and he joins us from the Carnegie Studios in New York with more. John Lloyd Young, start by telling us a little bit about the story of the Four Seasons.
Sure. The Four Seasons were working-class guys from Newark, New Jersey, from the projects, Italian-American guys involved with petty crime who just had a love for music and were playing clubs and restaurants and bowling alleys. Ultimately, a very famous film actor who I will not name.
Why?
Well, it ruins the surprise in the show.
Okay. Well, let's see. Let me give a clue.
Goodfellas.
Goodfellas. And how about... Ute. What do you mean, the Ute? Oh, Ute.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so he's so, a little guy.
So everyone knows who we're talking about now. As a kid, this famous Italian-American film actor.
Sure.
But a very big personality. Was in a band with Bob Gaudio. Bob Gaudio was the basketball player type, the tall guy of the Four Seasons, and the songwriter. Mm-hmm. This actor introduced Bob Gaudio to Frankie Valli, Tommy DeVito, and Nick Massey. Once Bob Gaudio came into the mix and there was a songwriter in the mix, it didn't take very long before they broke with Sherry.
John Lloyd Young, again, who plays Frankie Valli in Jersey Boys on Broadway. The story gets messy. One of the Four Seasons is, he's a hood. Tell me how that relationship between DeVito and Valli plays out.
It's a classic. You take the guy out of the neighborhood, but you can't take the neighborhood out of the guy. Here's a guy, Tommy DeVito, who was part and parcel, part of, you know, the main reason that the Four Seasons really got together. He pulled them out of the neighborhood and really pushed for them to become successful. In so doing, all the trappings and spoils of success were irresistible to a guy who was involved in crap games and gambling and shady mob dealings.
In fact, we have another scene from Jersey Boys here. You playing Frankie Valli ask for $150,000. Is it for DeVito?
It's to bail DeVito out.
Let's listen.
Tommy's in a little trouble.
A little?
$150,000.
So why isn't he standing there talking to me?
Because he can't sing My Mother's Eyes like I can.
You take care of family, Frankie. I like that.
You know, playing Frankie Valli's life was not so hard as singing his songs in front of him. When I first met him, he ambushed a rehearsal and suddenly I'm rehearsing the show in front of him.
What was it like? What did he say?
He was very gracious. I could tell he was also uncomfortable, as was I. But I knew it wasn't because he didn't like what I was doing, only because I think it probably is odd to see some young guy who sort of resembles you reliving your life.
What did he say about your voice?
He was very impressed. He gave me avuncular and maybe even grandfatherly advice about how to protect it.
How?
Basically, not to blow it out, to lay back a little bit. I assume it's probably not true, but I assume that I need to be more careful as a singer because I'm not a singer first. Mm. And as a result, I think I sing it in a more healthy and smarter way, which is the only way I think that anyone can get through 8 shows a week singing 27 songs in high falsetto.
Big Girls Don't Cry, John Lloyd Young singing. And John, we know you have to warm up your voice to sing these high falsetto songs. How do you do that?
I can tell you that it's very unsightly. I pull out a paper towel so that I have friction, and I pull my tongue and I hold it tight to stretch the back of my tongue. Because in rock singing, your tongue gets really bunched up in the back of your throat because it's a pushed form of singing. So in order to continue to sing that way, you've got to really stretch it out and make sure that it's loose. And you'd really just have to grab on and pull, and then you do your vocal exercises like that.
Can you do anything now?
Sure. Let's see. I'm pulling out a paper towel here. I'm going to pull my tongue. So imagine someone pulling their tongue with a paper towel.
All right.
This is, you know, for your ears only. No one's ever asked me to do this. Etc.
Oh, boy.
Down the octave.
But you know, even just in that little tiny thing, I heard it. I heard that, whatever that distinct thing is. And I'm thinking of the music. Dawn, Walk Like a Man. Marianne, Ragdoll. Have favorites?
Beggin' is a song that I didn't know before, but is just such a wonderful song. Mm. And it's just so driving and so aggressive, and also, like its title, there's something really raw about it. And on the album, it's my favorite.
I'm begging.
In the context of the show, Sherry, I think, is my favorite in terms of the build-up to it. Since this is the story of the Four Seasons, you don't come straight out of the gate getting Four Seasons songs. You've got to see their beginnings. And so it's 40 minutes before you even hear a signature Four Seasons song.
Mm-hmm.
By the time in the first act that we get to Sherry, which was their first big hit, the audience and actors alike are just chomping at the bit to get there.
You embody a rock star, and you have that experience during the show. What's that like? What do audiences do during Jersey Boys?
They go nuts, especially the demographic that grew up with this music.
Mm-hmm.
You can see them be transported back to when they were 16 years old, and this music was new. The line between actor and character disappears at certain points because you're really doing exactly what the Seasons did.
Mm-hmm.
You stop acting and just, you are a rock star for a number or two here and there.
Actor John Lloyd Young stars as Frankie Valli in the Broadway production of Jersey Boys. John Lloyd Young, thank you so much for speaking to us, and just can't wait to see what you do next.
Thanks, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin.